This week on Decentralized.
The unbundling of everything.
Is Bitcoin bigger than Google?
And then a discussion with prediction market pioneer Robin Hanson.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Jazz Ferguson.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralized.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 27 of Decentralized. For those of you listening on audio, you won't notice this, but we actually have our first video set up here, and we're kind of sitting here in panel style. So envision in your brain three grown men basically acting out the view here. But we have some interesting topics to talk about this week, and later on the show we'll
shoes?
Have... Yes. Shoes, and one of us will walk off, but you won't hear it.
I remember that.
So we have a number of good topics to talk about, and we have a guest on later on, Robin Hanson of George Mason University. Talk about prediction markets. But first, we obviously have some news and tech to cover, as well as some new ideas. And this week, I was reading through one of my favorite tech publications, TechCrunch, something we all are familiar with. And occasionally, they have a really good thought piece. One of these was the unbundling of everything. And for those familiar with kind of with the topic and the idea, this sort of idea looks at how services and goods are presented to consumers. Particularly in the area of technology, this article kind of addresses that, and it's basically saying that instead of now receiving everything all together, get all your channels together, all of your consumer goods in education and travel, and even in politics and even in maybe in employment, things which once were kind of sold together as a complete bill of goods are now being separated. So one thing that might look like is in education now, you have someone like Coursera or Khan Academy. They're taking apart kind of the lecture, the kind of content aspect of education and breaking that apart from what is normally considered to be the bundle of goods you buy in education. So the bundle of goods you buy if you take a college education is the ability to go party, the ability to sit in a classroom with a bunch of people your age, and I don't mean to hate on college here, I'm known for that, the ability to talk with really wise professors, like we're going to have one on later on the show. That's all considered one consumer good. But that's kind of a relic of an older way of thinking about things, a more concentrated economic power, more centralized structure. And what this article is observing is that a lot of the startups today that are actually making real progress are the ones that are doing things to actually unbundle that package of goods. So that's someone like Coursera or Khan Academy. But I'm wondering, sort of like, do you think this is something which you see going on in maybe your own fields of interest, and yeah. what's driving that for you?
Yeah, when I hear unbundling, I think of two things. I think of a la carte, which is the term I like. It just makes me hungry. I like that with everything to do with video and TV, instead of, you know, subscribing to the different tiers, you know, just get HBO now. And that's cool. That's been necessary for decades. Customers have wanted it. Cable companies have said, we need to do this. And cable companies are getting so many people turning it off and cutting it off that they're kind of forced to adapt or die. And the other is video games, you know, especially when a new console launches. And I don't necessarily know if this is the same application, but it bothers me because they'll say, okay, you can buy a Wii U the day of launch, but you need to purchase $400 in games with it in this bundle. I think bundling is just a bad choice for consumers. And I think in the end, it ends up hurting the businesses themselves because a lot of times consumers... If that's your choice, there are people, I'm not saying it's always a lot, that will say, okay, well, I choose not to buy that. You know, I haven't had cable for a couple years, and I don't miss it at all, you know, yeah. And you'd asked me that 10 years ago, I would have thought, no way. But you know what? The internet came around, and options came out. And, you know, having a variety of things to choose from is always a positive.
Yeah, so I go back even further, and I look at sort of the IBM antitrust case, mm-hmm. Which was sort of the first great unbundling, sort of mandatory from in technology, sort of mandatory because the government brought that suit against IBM. And even back to sort of like the early 1900s and some of the monopolies that existed in steel and railroad, etc. I think that centralization as a trend was simply because it's the easiest mechanism to deliver services, right? The more centralization is easier. The reason that, you know, the United States... even became a democracy, or it didn't become a true democracy, it was a democratic republic, was because, you know, it was easier to send a group of representatives, you know, how many or hundreds of miles it was across, you know, many, many days of travel to go vote on your behalf, right? In technology, the reason we're seeing, like, or we saw over the past couple decades, since, you know, the internet really became a thing, all the centralization was because it provided such a better user experience for people. Mm-hmm. Then it was much harder. We didn't have the accessibility of the tools to truly decentralize things. Today, we're starting to see a resurgence of decentralization because we have the answers to some of the problems and some of the difficulties of making these things accessible for people. And similarly, because, you know, the United States is, you know, I think it's 250, 300 years old, something like that. I don't even know. I'm great at this whole patriotism thing. Maybe 240. Wow. Okay. So maybe now that we actually have the technology and tools that make it easier for the people who are building these things to be more accessible and ultimately more consumable by your general, you know, non-technical population, maybe this is why we're starting to see BitNation and some of these entries into the governance space and even this unbundling of services from the entrepreneurial and software tech space. Yeah. Because it's just, now it's much easier to do these things.
Yeah, so the unbundling, kind of the development that's real interesting for me, and I'm very interested to see how that's further developed in all the companies we're seeing either on the show or just that kind of out in the space in general. And I'm sure TechCrunch will be able to cover their Series A funding rounds and whatnot, because they certainly like funding. But one of the things, you know, TechCrunch. One of the things which is, you know, gaining a lot of power without really, kind of under the surface, not so evident, obviously, is the Bitcoin network itself. It's something which, you know, underlies a lot of our ideas of decentralization that we're seeing unfolding in this experiment of a distributed network. And recently, a good Medium article came out. It's gotten a lot of press as well, called Bitcoin is Bigger Than Google. And it compared the hashing power, the computing power of the Bitcoin network, which obviously is very specifically focused toward that one function of mining and transaction verification. But they actually compared that to Google's computing network of, you know, their data centers of like football field size. And Bitcoin is now more powerful, even though it's more distributed, even though it's, you know, comprised of obviously both the big mining farms, right, and the small guys running a miner in their rooms.
And more specialized, I must point out.
Exactly, more specialized, more distributed, and also bigger than Google. And that's really interesting to me as an evidence of the power of these distributed networks and, like, the power of the incentive system especially. Like, I think that's probably the root power of this. But I'm wondering, you know, obviously working in a lot of different decentralized projects, one of the things I think we really need to do to see the success of other applications of the blockchain or what have you is to see how can we replicate the incentive structure that Bitcoin had to create a robust distributed network in the projects we're working on.
Yeah, I think actually, and this is not necessarily a direct response to that, but this topic in general, I actually think part of this is actually Bitcoin's one of Bitcoin's biggest flaws, and it actually is a two-pronged flaw. One is the amount of power it takes to run the network, right? Yeah. It's a problem. Everyone can pretend it's not. There's no reason. There is a reason, but that's something that can be improved. Let me put it that way. Number two is not many people ever discuss this. I have heard it before, and that's where I picked it up from, was someone else mentioning it, is the fact that so few mining manufacturers exist, and they're actually technically controlling Bitcoin and making it more centralized, the mining manufacturers. And you know, I think those are a couple flaws. So when you say things like that, my mind always races anyways, but my mind races in a few ways. One is, that's really neat, right? Cool. We're into this and it's growing.
Watch out, Google.
Yeah, exactly. And but also, then it goes to other problems that I see like that and, you know, the mining issue and ways that we can maybe make this giant network more efficient and remove any aspects of you know, centralization that could come into play, like the manufacturers that control mining rigs.
Yeah.
So I've had conversations with a few Google engineers about this, and when I share the news with them that, you know, the mining network is, you know, of Bitcoin is significantly larger than Google's cloud compute infrastructure, they're like, they have no idea. That sort of like hits them out of the blue, and they're like, what, really? And yeah, it's true, but it is more specialized. This is why x86, Intel, and the reason we're stuck with the computing infrastructure that we have today is because the general purpose computing infrastructure competed with a couple of other more specialized infrastructures, and it won because it could do many more things. So utility won out over efficiency. And this gets me to something you just said, which is, you know, you say that everybody pretends it's not a problem. Well, I say assertively, it is definitely not a problem. In fact, I say quite the opposite. It's a very good thing that electricity consumption is part of the Bitcoin network. Because, you know, how do you really value this, for the first time in history, this perfectly irrefutable record of history, right? That this, the fact that we could completely eliminate, you know, 40 to 60% of the population's, wow, I'm really going to get hired for senator now.
That sounds a bit, finish your sentence.
So like, if we literally, with the technology that, you know, the blockchain and Bitcoin provides now, there no longer is a need for a significant portion of manual human labor, of paper pushing that's going on right now. Because now we actually can replace that entire thing and end up with an ultimately more efficient system than what we had before. That's point one.
Yeah.
Point two is, if Bitcoin itself or any, you know, blockchain-based proof-of-work system, not delegated proof-of-stake or any of these other possible alternative proposals, if a proof-of-work system gets significant traction, even 5% of adoption, 5% penetration worldwide of whatever it does, right? The economics of electricity generation, of efficiency, even of the mining networks and their centralization, will be pushed towards a more efficient solution. So it's probably the single greatest way that we could ever fix our massive energy consumption problem, is by binding the use of electricity economically to a form of reward, directly, without any regulation, without any third party, without anything, just the direct economic effect of, in 50 years, when, you know, 80 to 90% of economic value is transferred through a blockchain proof of work secured system, then I guarantee you that there will be an entire economic series of effects and places where people are innovating in energy in energy usage and generation that we would never have seen otherwise.
I will say this, Senator Martindale, that
oh, good God.
Yeah, that from things I've studied, the way I've seen it, and explain, and please, by all means, correct me if I'm wrong, that when the idea of mining Bitcoin existed, it was really something that, you know, you could do on your laptop in the background while you're watching a movie or working on something. And then someone thought, GPUs can do this better. And then guess what happened? GPUs did it, and this became nonprofit. It became useless to mine on this. And then, you know, and that. Well, then what happened? I don't know. Did it go right to ASIC right from there?
No, we went to FPGAs.
And so on and so forth. So I think that the original design did not include this massive power drain that's happening, and the cost of power, and the issues that come with that. Now, I think maybe if you're in a cold climate area, it makes a little more sense. But if you're not, what it does, it also causes, like, a really big fire hazard. Isn't that one mining rig that died? It was a huge warehouse, I believe, that went up in flames.
Bad actors will be swept out of the system. People who do, you know, stupid things will...
They'll get burned?
Yeah, they'll get burned. But, I mean, to your point, like, it's about a lot more than cold climate, too. Like, governments who have managed their economy in the sense that there is subsidized electricity costs, miners are moving to those areas and disrupting that economic model. Right? Mm-hmm. Where there's, like, government enforcement of, like, electricity must cost this much, or, like, monopolies in cases where they've got, like, this arbitrarily low price. That's where the miners are moving. And Bitcoin, by its very existence, the very fact that miners are moving to those areas and electricity consumption is part of it, that is disrupting and changing that model, too. Now, it's far lower of an effect than, you know, if Bitcoin was much bigger, but it's still happening today. And as Bitcoin grows, so too will that impact. And I think that's really important to consider, and I think it could be a positive thing for the overall world. So
it's a very interesting thing to balance, you know, is sort of the centralization versus what we know is actually an incentive to compete the profits away. I mean, if there's an incentive there to actually produce more efficient mining, more effective mining, for one thing, the Bitcoin network benefits. It does grow more robust. Obviously, there are concerns about who's actually running all of those mining computers, but even with something like the distribution earlier on with the GPUs, CPUs, it wasn't necessarily less power being used, it was just more distributed. Now we're seeing it more centralized, we're seeing more what the cost actually is. One of the things I'm really interested in with Bitcoin is the role the cost of that mining plays in sort of signaling that you are like a legitimate node on the network, or that you're basically that transactions themselves are legitimate, that the transaction fees you pay are kind of signaling. And that's something our later guest, Robin Hansen, does work on in economics. So I think just in general, looking at this kind of problem with kind of the nuance economics gives as a way of thinking is really interesting and really helpful. And we've talked a little bit about economics on the show in the past and kind of some of our favorite economists. We've thrown out some quotes. We had Glenn Jacobs on, who wants to rewrite one of the great economics books of the 20th century.
Which is my favorite quote of that
indeed.
Episode, by the way.
Pro wrestlers, I mean, like, again, this shows you, like, economics is a way of thinking which I think everyone can benefit from, especially, you know, people in the tech industry and then decentralized tech especially, in understanding things. One way of looking at economics, and there are a lot of different branches of the schools and sciences.
Pseudosciences.
But as a way of understanding human action through the application of logic. And I think there's a lot of benefits of that for kind of technophiles. It's certainly helped me to kind of understand things like Bitcoin. It actually was the source of my interest in it. But I'm wondering for y'all, how has maybe your study of economics or maybe your study of tech brought you to economics? And how has that influenced your thought and I think maybe kind of your efficacy in thinking about these things?
Yeah, it really, Hayek was really the one that I got into, and it was through tech. It was through the Bitcoin idea. And you know, it does influence my thought. I'm not going to lie on that. I'm not necessarily, I don't ever consider myself well-read on economics.
Right.
One of my favorite things that happened to me was someone actually asked me, are you an economist? I'm like, no, I'm just a dude. Like, what? Like, no, I'm a dude. Like, and I mean that in a way that means I would never consider myself an expert in this, but it has influenced my thinking. It's influenced my thinking to the degree where it getting into it is after I got into Bitcoin, it's led to a position now where I'm not as bullish on Bitcoin becoming the de facto cryptocurrency as everyone else is. And I really do think that is something that came through economics. And that's not the only way, because tech has a lot to do with it. Moore's Law has a lot to do with it. You know, the idea of distributing networks. So it's a multifaceted issue. But I think there are so many multifaceted issues that economics can influence your thinking on. And it really does, you know, it can be from dating to playing video games to just so many things. So I think there is value there. And when I said earlier that it was a pseudoscience, what I mean by that is that, you know, everyone pretends that whatever economics they believe in is the truth. And I think there's, you know, always something to be gathered from a little bit of everything. Some are things that people agree with more, and others. Some are more provable than others. And you know, no one's convinced me that they're completely right, but there's a few that have completely convinced me that they're completely wrong. So it's interesting. And the older I get, the more I learn. And that's really the best thing you can do is learn about it, right? And alternative theories.
Yep.
So I love this topic because, you know, I love especially the show and how we sort of set things up, because it gets me thinking about things that I don't actually like take time out of my day to ever really think about. And this question in particular has me like thinking back to like, what was it that drew me that set me up for understanding and recognizing the value and importance of, you know, decentralized tech in at large and blockchain tech specifically? And I think the answer was that I grew up in technology, and I grew up without, anyone telling me what was morally right in technology. Like, as a kid, like being a little script kiddie, like,
we might be the last generation that had happened with.
Now, because everybody's told what to do, right, and what's right and what's wrong. Like, and maybe that's a unique opportunity that we have, and we should talk about that later. But, like, so for me, I grew up, like, exploring these things on my own and, like, doing things because they were I was fascinated that I could do them, and because, like, somebody else was impacted by them. Like AOL chat rooms you could totally own, IRC chat rooms you could totally get root on the server, and that was like a challenge, that was a puzzle to solve. And then later, like, you know, if a kid did that today, you know, he'd be locked up and sent to prison for a significant amount of time. So for me, like, I came from economics, like, I entered into, before I even, like, knew what economics were, really, like, not even in high school, I didn't really understand, but, like, I came from it from the approach of me having things at my fingertips, the ability to do these things, and the only thing that could stop me was my inability to comprehend or understand that system, right? I had technology available to me, so I had I had full freedom to do whatever I wanted on this new, amazing internet. Anything I touched, I could make it bend to my will. Yeah. And that was like my natural place to be. Then I got into high school and I heard the word laissez-faire. And I was like, okay, this economics thing is interesting. High school, whatever. I slowly through, you know, business and, you know, doing entrepreneurship, I finally got to this point where, like, I saw on the, you know, the mailing list, on the cryptography mailing list, like, this thing about Bitcoin. And it was fascinating, purely from a technological standpoint. But only once I saw, you know, Gavin burning the dollar bill, or I think it was either a dollar or a hundred, or I forget what it was. It was some news article. I started really thinking deeply about my use of Bitcoin and how cool it was that I could send money without going through a bank. And sort of thinking about, like, oh my gosh, there's like a whole economic philosophy here. There's a whole school of thought that resonated well with me as being someone who had freedom technologically. Like, now that freedom being exposed to people financially, and ultimately being free of people telling them they're allowed to do something versus not allowed to do something, and it ultimately exposed me to this idea of true liberty and true freedom.
What's so interesting, I think, about this time in, like, technology and history in general is that we are seeing a confluence of the hard sciences and technology with the social science of economics. And traditionally, those have been sort of interesting, have some interesting differences methodologically. Hayek actually pointed out, I mean, that one of his main areas of study was delineating the role of social sciences versus the methodologies of those. That sort of the hard sciences are more empirically, more fact-based, whereas the social sciences are going to be a bit more indeterminate in that sense. So relying more on kind of praxeology, on this human action study. So it's interesting now that we're seeing what's more of a empirically based hard science, computer science background merging with the understanding of how humans behave, how they act, what motivates them, what subjective value is, you know. That's quite interesting to see those intersections. So obviously our guest later on in the show is going to be talking sort of about how we can actually use technology to coordinate knowledge in the same way that prices do. Actually use technology as a platform for prices in the field of prediction markets. So we're definitely really excited talking about that. But just to wrap up, I mean, what are you kind of seeing in the decentralization space right now, which you think is an especially interesting application of economic insights, economic thinking?
Well, I would say the project that Robin is actually an advisor on that I'm a part of, Augur, is definitely a part of that. And I hate to use the cop-out and talk about and promote my thing and shill what we're selling, but, you know, it's a completely different way of thinking. And it really, it's something that I had very little idea about, that even it was influenced by economics. To me, they were drastically different topics. And, you know, and then you realize kind of how few people have heard about this theory. And that really did influence me. And the point I would like to make, because that's really the best example that I have and the one I want to use, is the problem that bothers me about economics and being taught in schools is that it's taught as fact, whatever you're learning. I don't like that. I really wish that there was more wiggle room in what is taught. I wish there was more wiggle room on what's discussed and what's considered serious and taken seriously. Because an idea like prediction markets, academia really actually digs it a lot. But it's not something that's taught often. And that's really odd, right? And the reason it's not taught often is because there are regulations against you know, a lot of ways that this could be proven to work. So, you know, it's interesting, and there's really, I'm sure there's a lot of other examples and projects, and Eric, I'll let you answer right now, because you might have some more that I've never even thinking of.
Not examples of projects per se, but, I mean, you raise an interesting point. Like, the school doesn't really teach the Socratic method anymore. It doesn't teach you how to approach problems. It teaches you what the answer is.
Yep.
And I think that the impact of that for the past a little more than 100 years of, you know, this ridiculously centralized education system has resulted in some very bad, a very bad direction for overall society. And I don't think it's acute to one generation or another. I think it's a much broader issue of people just don't do critical thinking anymore and evaluate economics from like a critical thinking perspective. Yeah. You know, so I think that ultimately is the essence of the problem. And if we start teaching people how to approach it from that direction, we could probably change the course of history and we may not end up in this economic collapse we're all talking
and
about.
And encourage it. If teachers encourage it, that's all it would need. Really.
I think that should be the sole method of teaching, and mm-hmm. I think that's why for the past 30 years, the education, the university system specifically, and for more than that, the education system at large, has been in such massive decline. And I think it's going to lead to, ultimately, a potential collapse. I hope that that's not true, but that's my perspective on it.
It's very interesting. No, it's interesting for me. I mean, I discovered economics probably in my freshman year of high school, actually. Really dug into it and really excited my passions. And it was probably a turning point for me in my own personal education. And it was something which, you know, for a good part was not really very encouraged in school. But that's okay because we can work around those things now. It's kind of like philosophy, and that's kind of the mother of the sciences, and that it really does apply to everything, like you said. So that's why I really love it. It's also why I really geeked out to talk to our guests today. So until next week, decentralized listeners, explore economics. That's your call to action.
And up next, we have Robin Hanson. All right. This week, our guest is Robin Hanson, who's the Associate Professor of Economics at George Mason University, and also an author at overcomingbias.com. Robin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be here. What are we going to talk about?
So for our listeners, why don't you just describe a little bit about, you know, what you do for work? What are your main areas that you talk about, that you teach, and that you study?
I'm all across the map, so unfortunately that means that it's a longer answer than for most people. I do some things on social implications of future technology. I do some things on trying to understand and collect strange things people do and make sense of them. And I also work on something called prediction markets, our methods of information aggregation. So I've found that there's a lot of problems in the world and a lot of ideas for solving them. And I've tried to contribute some ideas like prediction markets. But often these ideas we generate run into the problem that we often take people at their word at what they say they're trying to do. And we produce a solution that gives them what they said they wanted, and turns out they lie about what they want. And that's a problem for us generating solutions for them.
That's
in part.
So I think that may also be the case because, you know, people often don't necessarily know what they want. There's some, like, you know, right. Psychology behind this, right? Do you get into that in your study?
Sure, yes, absolutely. Try to understand why people aren't aware of what they want and why would there be such a big disconnect between what they think they want and what they actually want.
And I think that's really something that you hammered home the first time I heard you speak, and that was the first time I met you at the O'Reilly Blockchain Summit in San Francisco. And it was an interesting point I think the example you gave was in management, about how they don't always want to know what exactly is the most likely thing they're going to do or the best thing to do. They want to do what they want to do, and that's just human psychology. And it really, you know, illustrates, I think, a lot of different aspects of prediction markets and just the way that they can be perceived and the accuracy that they can have if they're really, you know, large enough and there's a large enough pool of people.
So are we getting ahead of ourselves?
Absolutely. I sometimes forget that this is the introduction. Absolutely. I'm going to let Eric go next because I've had a chance to speak with you multiple times, so I've sat under the learning tree, and I'm going to let them go ahead too. So,
sure. So, Robin, what got you into this field of research? What sort of got brought about, you know, your interest in decentralized or prediction markets in general, and then ultimately decentralized prediction markets?
You know, I, like many other people, just interested in solving various problems of the world, and many problems in the world. You know, we think of institutions to solve it, different arrangements that might change people's incentives and what they tell each other. And many of the institutions we have are basically put some guy in charge and tell him to solve the problem somehow. And that's, in a sense, the generic centralized solution. Somebody in charge and make them responsible for solving it. And so, in some sense, people think of anything else as decentralized relative to the put a guy in charge solution. So in that sense, anybody who's interested in designing institutions is implicitly interested in decentralized solutions because they're trying to do something else than put one guy in charge and tell him to solve it.
So I hear a lot of Hayekian influence in sort of your background, your explanation of institutions' roles in coordinating human action here. How has your sort of your background in economics influenced your thinking on prediction markets and your interest in them?
Well, actually, the order came the other way, in a sense. So I was hanging around a place called Xanadu, which was an early group of people who foresaw the web and imagined what the web would be. And they imagined that backlinks would be the key to making good conversation on the web and making good, solid beliefs. And I came to doubt how well backlinks might work. And since they were rabid libertarians, the idea of just having vending markets on these things came naturally to mind, and I, you know, tried to explore that, and then I sort of felt like I ran into roadblocks not having enough context and credentials, and so I decided to go back to school to get a PhD, and then I learned economics and social science much greater depth. So in a sense, prediction markets brought me to economics more than the other way around.
It's interesting that you brought up Xanadu, and what exactly did you think of the World Wide Web when it first came to be, and the you know, the opposing viewpoints that I hear existed at the time on the two?
Oh, well, I mean, the people that I was hanging around Xanadu, they had a very detailed and ambitious goal in mind and a very integrated design. And they kept sort of adding features to it and raising the bar for what it had to be, which is why, in part, they didn't deliver very quickly. And so when the World Wide Web first showed up, to them it looked way too cut-rate and simple because it didn't have all the features they wanted and all the, you know, guarantees it was going to give and things like that. But I think most of them have come to acknowledge that that's the right thing to do first, to do something fast and simple and robust and get it out there. And they had made a mistake in trying to add too many features and to make it too high a definition of what they were trying to do.
Yeah, so I was aware of the Xanadu project, and I followed it for a number of years. And what fascinated me is that it actually predated the World Wide Web and the idea of, unidirectional links. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think just last year, I think they finally shipped after 40 years, maybe, of a prototype, actually, an example of this. And that's, it strikes me that, you know, speaking from an entrepreneurial background, that the you need to start small and progress iteratively. Do you think that,
right,
what other lessons do you think could be learned from sort of the model of Xanadu as like a world-changing technology? Looking at it in retrospect, it looks like, you know, it could have been superior, but it just didn't get to market fast enough. What other lessons are there to be gained from the case of Xanadu?
Well, I mean, I think there's a bunch of just standard lessons that old fogies who've been around sort of know that basically young people have to learn again. And it's one of these mysteries of human nature. Why do we keep having to relearn things? Why can't we just tell each other across the generations? But certainly this is one of the standard ones, which is, if you're going to have an idea, have a product, have something to make a big difference, it needs to be pretty simple. And it needs to be simpler than most young people tend to imagine. It needs to be pretty straightforward because there's just going to be so many complications you're going to have to deal with. People tend to abstract away from the complications. They tend to say, well, let's just focus on this basic problem and then worry about the other things later. But those other things are most of the real problem. So you got to get to them as fast as you can and plow through them. So there's no escaping dealing with all the actual problems, no matter how mundane or less great, you know, grand than you were hoping. I mean, you know, some of the problems real business has to deal with are grand and the sort of thing you want to talk about in a big talk and the vision of concepts and high-level goals. And others are just like, you know, very mundane little things, you know, like these two people don't get along, or how do I tell this funder that, you know, their paperwork so their taxes go, or, you know, there's just a lot of little things that have to, and basically most businesses fail on some stupid little thing not being done right.
Yeah, absolutely. Attention to detail is extremely important, in my opinion. That sort of gets me to the next question. I know that you were involved in the Cypherpunk, you know, mailing list. Did that follow the Xanadu involvement that you had? What got you excited about that, and what was your interest?
Well, I mean, that's, again, this idea that there's some, like, abstract software capabilities that could then be realized and produce interesting real social outcomes. And, you know, the people who implemented, say, the Cypherpunk based products, that they did like take the advice to Siri, and they didn't try to add too many features, and they did try to keep it simple and robust, and you know, they tended to be more solid about knowing how to do those things, but you know, that's a great example of being sure that the people who say they want something really want it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. So I mean, back at the time of Cyberpunks, you know, almost any time people talked about the future of computing in the media or a book or something like that, the issue of privacy came up, and it was always a really big deal. Everybody talked as if privacy was this really big, important thing, and of course, legislation was trying to discuss it and deal with it, and Cypherpunks was basically saying, hey, we can produce more privacy, and we could just like make PGP email and it'll add privacy. And surely if people want privacy as much as they talk about, all we have to do is offer it to them at you know, relatively low cost, and surely that will be the end of the game, right?
Exactly.
It turned out people just did not actually want privacy nearly as much as they talked about it in grand talking head shows or whatever. And so it, even the small cost that it took to adopt something like PGP was in fact higher cost than most people were willing to pay. And even though the software was created and it was robust and it was solid and distributed widely, it in fact was hardly ever used.
Yeah. So and do you think that the part of that is the accessibility of that? Like, I'm sure in, you know, 1992, 93, in the very early days when PGP became a thing, that it probably was comparatively easy to use then. But then we go and look at today, and even in the business world today, we're trying to get people to, you know, secure their communications. And email is so widely prevalent today that, and PGP is like really one of the only answers that we have to secure that system. Do you think that part of it is related to the user experience or making it easier to use or perhaps even enabled by default? Or do you genuinely think that it was just people didn't want it?
Oh, no, I think, you know, all else equally, I might take it. It's not that they disliked it, but it's just their positive value for it was so small that even these small deals of trouble were enough for them. I mean, you know, and it's an important thing about scale economies. You know, we want to use tools that everybody else uses, and there's big advantages in all sharing the same tool. So people building a tool have to decide, you know, do most people using this tool want this feature enough for me to bother to implement it and pay the costs of supporting it? And they, most of them decided, no, most people did not want to bother with this, you know, privacy enabling features because no, that was going to be too much trouble. And they weren't actually willing to bother with the trouble. So, which is disappointing, of course, from the grand point of view of everybody talking about how important privacy was, it seems kind of crazy that people would be that close to it and not actually take it.
Yeah. But
yeah,
that's the real thing, that people really actually didn't care very much.
And now that, you know, it's, what, 20 years later, and we're talking about something like the cypherpunks' involvement in this, two questions here. Did you at the time think that it would become this influential? And now, what do you think of it now, and that you're hearing, you know, completely different people who are not born yet discussing these issues and referring to posts from 1992?
Right. Well, of course, I mean, it is heartening that these issues don't go away entirely, and one of the hopes many people have is that, you know, it just takes a long time to make these changes, and if you stick with it long enough, eventually you could win, and just because you don't win in 20 years doesn't mean you don't win eventually. So that's the kind of hopeful scenario. But the other thing is just ask, okay, it's different, and are those differences enough? So some people say, okay, people don't care very much about privacy, you're right, but they do care about money. And, you know, if you can give them more money enough through using, you know, the cryptocurrencies, then maybe they will bother with this where they didn't bother with email privacy because maybe they really do care more about this. I mean, so that's the bottom line question. A lot of people talk about caring about, say, the privacy of their money. And the question is, how much do they actually care about the privacy of their money?
It's very interesting. I mean, we encounter those trade-offs a lot in kind of exploring decentralized technologies. There's kind of a user benefit trade-off. There's obviously, like you said, the scaling trade-off. And I imagine sort of having an understanding of economics and those kind of value decisions is very helpful for understanding why people act the way they do. Having been a part of the cypherpunk movement, what sort of advice or understanding do you think economics can offer to movements in general? Do you think having a movement is actually an effective way of introducing change, or do you think we really need to kind of think about other ways of kind of changing behavior or incentivizing it?
Well, honestly, you talk about like what can economics bring, but I think economists are actually pretty naive too about taking people at the word for what they want. Economists, like, you know, economists who study medicine mostly assume that people want out of medicine what they say they want, which is to be healthy. And in fact, that doesn't seem to work so well as an explanatory framework for understanding medicine. And similarly for education, most economists who deal with education assume they're going to school to learn things, et cetera. So, I wouldn't necessarily give economists that much credit for, you know, digging behind the scenes and seeing what's really going on. You basically have to figure out what do people want, and can you get it for them? Mm. Here, rephrase the question, I guess.
Yeah. So I guess the question is sort of is understanding sort of how human behaviors change, and I think that's a great answer to it, is really just kind of find actually what people actually want, not their stated preferences, but their revealed ones.
Well, you asked about a movement.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the key things a movement is like get past some initial point of awkwardness and a scale, insufficient scale, to get you to the point where there's sufficient scale and awkwardness. But I think the key point is you will have to transition. So you can't think of the movement solution as the permanent solution. I mean, movement is a temporary thing that creates enthusiasm and creates energy, creates a willingness to suffer even in the short term to be part of something. But then eventually people go on to other things, the fashions change, the interests change. And at that point, you have to ask what's left, right? And so you'll need to have a big enough community of users using something that's easy enough and something that they value enough, even when it's not a fashion, and even when it's not like getting them kudos at parties or whatever, that they'll keep using it. And that's the hard part. I mean, a lot of things people will suffer with an awful lot so they can brag about it at parties.
Yeah.
So the hard part is to get them to suffer with it later when it's not in fashion.
Yeah. I mean, speaking from the perspective of someone who puts himself through, absurd hurdles, quite frankly, just so that I can like make sure that what I have is secure. I would say that none of this stuff is ready for public consumption yet. Like, even when we start talking about Bitcoin, which is now sort of achieved widespread attention at the very least, it's just not ready. And as you talk, it sort of reminds me of the Gartner hype cycle, right? So where do you think we are? I mean, maybe there's like three or four different fields here between like, you know, cryptography and privacy and currency and privacy and some of these things. But where do you think on each of these things that we are with the Gartner hype cycle?
Well, I can speak best to prediction markets because I've been tracking that very closely and I think I understand that very well. I'm really more in the periphery of cryptocurrency. And so I can't really speak very expertly about current trends or
sure.
exactly who's doing what or what's likely to happen soon. I can talk about the fundamentals of like what determines whether it wins or loses in the end. And like the basic issue of whether people want the product or not or which kind of products that could be here. I can speak to those more, but in terms of like where we are in a cycle, I can't speak about the prediction markets. I can at least talk a bit more about the fundamentals.
Sure. Please go right ahead.
There's a lot of overlap between the emotional appeal of prediction markets to many people and the emotional appeal of cryptocurrency. There's this idea that there's these authorities out there, there's the man, and he's stopping us from our freedom, and we're getting in our way, and we just want to do our own thing, man. And you know, there's the feeling that we want the ability to do things without permission, Abby, and we've been having to ask for permission, and we should just have the right to the ability to do things without permission. And that sort of feeling of wanting to do things that are forbidden or wanting to have the freedom to choose for yourself is a strong emotional appeal in the abstract and even as sort of a part of a movement identity and being with other people. And I think both of those both are part of the appeal of cryptocurrency and prediction markets. But I think that doesn't last really as a basic product to get people to actually do stuff when it's not in fashion, when there's not a movement. So in prediction markets, I think, you know, there are people who just want to bet as speculation and fun and entertainment. People have always been doing that, of course, betting on sports, etc. And there are legal limits on that, and so that reduces the quantity of amount people do. And if you could evade some of those legal limits, then there would be some more of that, but not vastly more. And I'm not sure it would actually make the world much of a better place if more people bet on sports. But the other interesting product is like organizations who want to know things, like a company who wants to know if they'll make a project deadline. And there's the new thing of using prediction markets to find those things out and giving organizations a mechanism to add that. And that's a sort of thing that if organizations could use prediction markets to find out if they'll make deadlines, that can last past some fashion cycle or some trying to stick it to the man sort of energy. But it depends on people and organizations actually wanting to know that. In sports betting, in betting, for example, there's a lot of sports betting, and then there's a lot of intellectual type people who think sports betting is boring. But wouldn't it be fun to bet on something more interesting, like particle physics or, you know, some latest result in psychology? And yes, that would be, and that fits their self-identity as the sort of thing they might like to do. But the fact is, they most of them won't actually want to bother to do that because, you know, even if it were legal, they just like distract. They have other things they want to do. They're not really that far into that. I mean, people who are into sports are like really into sports, and sports betting people are like crazy into it. And, you know, it takes a lot of people who are that crazy into something to make a big demand for it. So in prediction markets, the fundamental question is, are enough organizations actually interested in finding out answers to key questions like, what will sales be? When will we complete our deadline? What would happen if we change this? It seems in the abstract like there's huge value to be produced there, that as organizations seem to make those estimates really badly an awful lot. And all the data we have about previous experience suggests the prediction markets can substantially increase the accuracy of those sorts of estimates at a pretty low cost. Nevertheless, a lot of organizations act as if they don't really want that information. Not really, given the political costs of making people look bad. And well, so that's an open question for prediction markets in general and for prediction markets, say, connected with blockchains and like that, is how much individual and organizations really want to bother to produce that information and to get it.
Where do you think that resistance comes from? I mean, I see this in a lot of capacities. Do you think it's a natural resistance to change, or is it something else?
Something else, actually. That is, organizations that have had prediction markets in them, that they've tried them out, people have gotten used to them, they've gotten successful numbers, surveys have said people like it, they enjoy it, it's giving them satisfaction, they're getting useful information, even then they don't continue it. When, like, a particular manager is made to look bad by a prediction market that says that they were wrong or at fault about something. So some of the most successful prediction markets in firms have been markets that predict project deadlines. Like, will we make this deadline? And there's a lot of dramatic examples of the manager and the official people said, yes, of course, we're going to make the deadline. It's on schedule. And then you open a prediction market and the people at the bottom all over the place, they get to participate and they say, no way, no chance, you know, a few percent chance at most, guys. They're not going to make that deadline. And, of course, that makes the guy running the project look bad. It's useful information, obviously. It's actionable information, but it still makes people look bad. And the standard story on project failure is most people who have a project, if they expect a failure, what the story they want to tell afterward, they want to set themselves up for the story, which is, the thing that made us fail, no one could have seen that coming. It was just out of the blue. Who could have seen that?
Yeah.
So it's not my fault. It's nobody's fault, because nobody could have seen that coming.
Uh-huh.
And that's a standard story. Not only do they want to tell that story, their boss wants to tell that story, because their boss looks bad if they look bad. And so everybody wants to pass up the story. Hey, no one could have seen that coming. But of course, a prediction market, if it kept saying it's not going to happen, it doesn't really fit the story that, boom, something came out of the blue that no one could have seen coming. Because it was saying, hey, we saw it coming.
Right. It's an admission that the machine is better than us, then the math is better than us, right? And that's something we're afraid of. And I think maybe
I don't think it's about the machine. I mean, people understand that these things are just other people at the end of it. It's just like, you know, a telephone line. It's not you blame the wire or something. You
sure.
Blame the guy on the other end of the phone and what they were saying.
Right. So that's a great point. You sort of broadening the discussion a bit. You talk a lot about the idea of futurarchy from a political perspective. Can you expand a little bit on that and what that means?
Sure. So a simple prediction market, as we've been talking about for a while, is just there's a claim like, will we make the deadline? And then there's a people get to bet on it, basically, and they buy and sell bets. And people have an incentive to set the market odds to be whatever they think is the correct odds for estimating what's likely to happen, because if they think the market odd is wrong, then they make money by correcting it. We can extend the simple idea of predicting things to what's called a decision market, where we bet on the consequence of a decision. So we might say, okay, it looks like we're not going to make the deadline if we do nothing. What if we add more personnel? What if we redefine the feature set? What if we move the deadline later? Right? We can ask, if we did something different, what are the outcomes? So a decision market is a set of markets about the consequence of a decision, and if they're really directly set up to tell you about the consequence of a decision, they can advise you about what to do. They could say, hey, if you want, you know, if you want to make the deadline, this is what you got to do. So futurarchy is really just another name for setting up a decision market in an organization around sort of the organization's fundamental goal, so that we try to do whatever it is maximizes our goal. So in a for-profit corporation, for example, we might take a stock price as a good proxy for what we want. What do we all want? We all want our company to be worth more. We're going to do whatever it takes to make the company worth more. What do we do? So a decision markers could say, well, if you hire this guy, it looks like that'll make the company be worth more. If you fire this guy, it'll make the company work more. If you add this product, if you drop that product, or whatever, they would just say the consequence of each decision for this key metric of what's the company going to be worth. So a futarchy is really just setting up decision markets about key decisions of an organization connected to the key outcome the organization has agreed to care about, such as the stock price. Now, in other organizations, such as a nonprofit, you could pick some other measure of the outcome you care about, like the number of lives you've saved or some awards you might get or whatever else it is. But the key idea of a futarchy is set up an organization and make the key decisions based on what a speculative market says about which outcomes will be produced by which choices. So it's not something that we haven't really been able to get people to try. So a lot of organizations have tried prediction markets where they just straight predict sales or project completion dates and things like that. But these conditional markets are a little harder to do. In a sense, they're more sensitive because they're closer to a decision. So they more obviously tell you what to do. So they give you less excuse if you choose not to follow the advice.
So why are these prices...
In fact...
Sorry?
Go ahead.
Continue. If you don't mind my interjection. So I'm wondering sort of about futarchy and the idea of kind of using prices to coordinate decisions. Why are prices better than votes in this instance? What's really special about the market aspect of this, in your opinion?
Well, you want to separate out value decisions from fact-based estimates. That is where, I'd say vote on values, but bet on beliefs. So the best... Maybe voting is a good way to aggregate values, to weigh us all and decide what we want. But betting is a better way to figure out what we believe, what is true. Voting doesn't tell you what's true. Voting tells you what somebody wants. So you don't necessarily have a good incentive with voting to figure out what the truth is and tell it to everybody. But betting, you do. So I'm not saying betting should be everything. I mean, there's obviously we do have to figure out values. We have to aggregate values and decide what we want. And that's a key thing we all have to do. And betting doesn't do that as well. But we also, in fact, mostly have to figure out how to get what we want. And yeah. Betting is a great way to figure out how to get what we want.
Absolutely. And I think that, your position as, I would say, the godfather of prediction markets, that is the nickname I will use from the rest of this podcast now, has given you, a unique position, especially in the past couple years because of the emergence of Nate Silver. And, obviously, I think that the fact that he was covering baseball really made it something that was easier to consume for the public because a lot of people like sports, as you were saying. He's brought your ideas to that entirely new audience. And I have to say that a lot of that line of thinking was new to me when I first researched him and learned more. What do you think about the statements that he made about you? Have you had contact with them? And what exactly do you think that he's done positive in saying that a prediction market of enough scale would outperform his model?
Nate and I, had lunch one day when he was writing his book, so we met personally and had a long conversation. And he's a smart guy. He's a personable guy. I like him. I'm not sure prediction markets have thrived in the time period since he wrote his book, so I don't necessarily see a connection there between prediction markets thriving per se. I'm not blaming him for that per se, but I don't necessarily see a big demand. I see more of a demand for what people is called big data or statistical analysis. And in fact, within most organizations, there is usually a much bigger demand for hiring a specialist to give an analysis than there is for a prediction market. And unfortunately, one of the reasons for that is that if the guy gives you the wrong answer in statistical analysis, you can basically tell him to go back and do it again until you get the answer you want. That's extremely common for people doing analysis for companies. And so that makes people more comfortable with that process. Prediction market has the problem that it's just hard to fudge. You commit to this process and then it produces this answer and it's visible and it might not be the answer you want.
Yeah, and in my comment, I actually misspoke. I actually should have been clearer and spoke about the entire Bayesian thought of statistics and that method. I should have been clearer there. I apologize. Because you're completely right about the prediction market the comment. And other than Intrade, it has not been that huge. So I just wanted to clarify what I meant there. So sorry about that.
Yeah.
So go ahead. Okay, so
we have an awesome Google Hangout lag.
Yeah. So, as you talk about futarchy, it strikes me this concept of the machine, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier.
that there is a certain sense of autonomy that can be created, right? You could, in theory, create an autonomous system to follow one of these prediction markets and even feed questions into it and then outsource sort of like its control mechanism. Do you think that there is an important human element to taking the insight gained from a prediction market? Or is this something that could be automated and perhaps might enable a future Skynet?
Great question.
Well, I think it's certainly possible to create many kinds of organizations that are not like the usual organizations. And computer elements can be part of them, but just lots of people. So there's two distinctions we're focused on here. We should. One is just the standard organization as we have it now is a human hierarchy, right? There's people at the top, and they are in control, and they delegate down, and then people do things at the bottom. And in that structure, we could imagine other structures besides a hierarchy, but that organize people, such as a prediction market or voting or a market. And within another structure like that, you could also imagine swapping out some of the components for machines. So I think the machine versus person sitting in these slots is really less interesting or less important than the overall structure. And we're just a long way away from being able to have machines swap in for people anyway, so, but eventually we will. But I think the how do people feel about organizations that aren't hierarchies? And I think people are a little two-faced about this. So at the first level, most people dislike hierarchy at an intuitive level. They think, you know, they're suspicious of big business, they're suspicious of big government, and they think we're all should just be better off being, you know, small is beautiful, being small groups and small and voting. And people like abstractly the idea of being in organizations that aren't hierarchies. That's what people say. But when people choose, like, where to work and what to do, they actually choose hierarchies pretty consistently. And there's a lot of data suggesting, like, other sorts of work organizations are substantially less productive. And so now, you know, we have to ask, well, what's going on? Why do people so consistently choose and defer to hierarchies, and they badmouth it so much? You know, so one answer, of course, and it's partly true, is that hierarchies have a lot more flexibility than people like to give them credit for. You know, the guy at the top can quickly change issues, change focus. He can get things done. You don't have to specify a lot of rules. There's going to be a lot of hidden and unanticipated issues that can be dealt with immediately and straightforwardly in a hierarchy. So hierarchies deserve because there's actually a lot of decisions that do require a few central people to get. Okay, there's some truth to that, but I don't think that's all the truth. So, like, one standard story of a hierarchy, managers in a hierarchy, is that they are like scientists, right? So people go to business school, and the image you get out of business school and they like to project is, well, decisions need to be made. And so I collect information and process it, and I put it in my spreadsheet, and I calculate the best thing to do, and then I send the orders down, but I have lots of meetings. And people want to present it as a big sort of calculational machine, right? And that's kind of bullshit to a certain degree. In a sense, managers are more fundamentally politicians than they are, right? There are these big, complicated coalitions that need to be built, and managers, like, in a sense, put more effort into being inspiring and being and motivating people and creating the impression of a movement towards something. There's just an awful lot more sort of managing impressions and you know, making people feel comfortable and people, you know, than there is like calculating. So it makes sense if you think about organizations that way, that if they've been telling the story of being a great decision maker, but what they really are is politicians and motivators, then if, you know, their story of what they're doing, being the calculator, that story implies the prediction market should be pretty because that's what they say, that's what they say they want to do. But it can get in the way of the other things they're really doing. So as a concrete example, say you've got a project deadline, and how does effort depend on whether the chances will make the deadline? And so a standard observation, if we're really sure to make the deadline or we're really sure not to make the deadline, why should I work hard on this project, right? It's when I'm on the edge of thinking we might or might not make the deadline, that's when I'm really motivated to work hard. And managers know that. And so managers quite often want to put their workers on the edge of believing we may or may not make the deadline, let's all work together and do it. And so if the truth is not right close to that edge, they'll want to lie about the truth to put their workers believing right on the edge so they can work hard. And so managers often really do try to manage the impression of whether we'll make the deadline in order to produce more effort, and it's less about accuracy in making the deadline. And there's a lot of other data that seems to support this. So for example, managers, software engineer managers who are accurate about predicting projects are less liked by their supervisors than ones who are more optimistic.
That's an unfortunate case, but seemingly accurate. You know, as my experience as a software engineer, I've seen this in the flesh, in real world organizations. So,
right. So I think as an advocate of prediction market, I have to say, if you want information, this is a great way to do it. But I'm not going to claim information is the only thing anybody should ever want. And I can, there are situations where information gets in the way of other things. Basically, if you're trying to trick people into something, you know, or manage their impression in an inaccurate way to motivate them, then yeah, accurate forecasts may get in your way.
Right. Okay. So let's pivot a little bit, and we're starting to come to the end of our duration here. So I want to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about your role at Consensus Point. Describe to the audience Consensus Point and what your participation in it is.
Consensus Point is a for-profit firm that provides prediction market software and services. And, you know, I've been advising them for many years. There are a number of firms in the area which have been trying to provide software, you know, and services in the prediction market area. The industry has certainly evolved a lot over the last decade. And, you know, we could talk about that and how other companies might fit in there. But I'm eager to help companies try out prediction markets. And I've learned, and many we've all learned many things about what companies really seem to want more in prediction markets and what they don't want. And they're still working at it, and they're having some success. They're focused in the area of, at the moment, focused in the area of basically substituting for focus groups in customer and evaluations of products. You know, which is a reasonable thing to do, but it is sort of moving away from the core. In some sense, the most sensitive topics in companies are the topics where big people in the company are felt responsible for them. So the safest subjects are the ones farthest from that. So people are the most comfortable using prediction markets to forecast customers, competitors, suppliers,
yeah,
or even like new projects that nobody's doing yet. I wonder if anybody should do. Because for all of these things, there are fewer people in the company who will look bad for any particular answer. Problem is prediction market. If you put up a market and one of the answers will make somebody look bad, well, they won't like that. Mm-hmm. So you try to like take it far away from anybody around who will have it look bad. So it's you know, if you ask about which versions of a product customers will like, that doesn't tend to make anybody in the company look bad. So
yeah, absolutely,
we do that.
Yeah. So you also have, as I understand it, become an advisor for Tony's company, Augur.
Yes.
Can you describe a little bit about how that came to be and your relationship there?
Well, I mean, they could say more about how. They said, would you like to be an advisor? And I said, sure.
I can absolutely give us some background on that. I was actually flown into town, and that was my second day there. And we were at the convention, and Jeremy, a member of our team, invited you out to dinner with us. And I was thrilled. Jack and Joey were really excited. I thought Joey was, you know, going to freak out. He was very into meeting you. And we were all very excited. So we got a chance to chat with you and learn. You know, I think that night you stayed until like 11 p.m. at the Augur House just talking about, you know, various aspects of not just prediction markets, but a lot of different things. And we asked, and I accepted, and here we are. And we've had I've personally had a couple meetings with you discussing various issues with it, and you know, positive, negative, what we can do, what we shouldn't do, a lot of different variables, a lot of different aspects. And you've really given us some good advice on a variety of things. And you know, it's something where having someone that's as influential to this line of thinking as you as an advisor is invaluable. I can't say enough about how much it's helped us and how much we're appreciative of it. And, you know, what we're doing is different. And, you know, and as you can tell, and I would like to get you to speak on this for a second, if you have it, is, you know, the addition of decentralizing it has the opportunity to solve issues. And the brilliance of the way that Jack and Joey preceded the Oracle problem, I think, is another real benefit to what we're offering. And there's so many interesting parts of it other than that, but what do you think about Augur and, you know, in general, and what you've learned from working with the team and just general feelings of it?
Well, I think, I mean, the most of it, I mean, Augur is not just a prediction market company. It's a blockchain-based prediction market company. And so the interesting question there is, what is the differential market or the added market for that extra set of features that that enables? So, I mean, I know a lot about prediction markets in general and who wants them and what they can do with them. I know less, and we all know less, about to what extent are people willing to pay the extra costs for the implementation tools that you're using to get the extra benefits that those tools allow, which are basically to do things without permission, in a sense. That is, you set up these markets and there's nobody in charge. They aren't in any one place. And so it's hard for anybody to say stop that because there's nobody to say it to. And so there presumably is some demand for markets like that. But the open question is how much and, you know, where are the people who don't have markets today? Because if they made one, someone would say stop that. And you could now make a market where nobody can say stop that. Which questions will that be on, and who will want to do that? You know, and I honestly don't know. As I say, you know, I just think at the very basic level, you ignore that feature just because most companies actually are free to create prediction markets within themselves. That's actually not a problem. So this really can't mainly be for them because they already have the ability to do what they want if they want to do something. And the main interesting thing is they aren't that interested in doing things. But within markets that cross organizational boundaries that involve people from several organizations or just very broad public markets, those are things where there's more barriers at the moment. So those are more places where this new approach could allow more activity. And the basic question is, how many people want that and at what trouble? Of course, and, you know, as we talked about before, there's how much value people place on it, and there's also how easy do you make it? And of course, that's the thing in your control. But the question is how many people want, like, to be able to bet on things that they don't have permission to bet on. And people like the idea that, you know, they should be allowed to do things that they aren't now allowed to do. They dislike being told what they can't do. Mm-hmm. But once they're allowed to do things, that doesn't mean they actually do them. So,
okay, so we are coming to a close now, though. Is there anything that we haven't covered today? Maybe some places where people can find more information about your work? I'm sure you've got a page on your university's website. Where can people find you? Where can they find information?
Google my name. I'll show up at the top. So.
All right.
That's the best answer we've gotten so far.
It is.
It's a straight
answer. All right, guys. So just Google Robin Hanson, and you'll be able to find his work on all of these things. Is there anything else you want to cover before we part ways?
There'd be lots of interesting subjects to continue, but they'd probably all take more than 2 minutes. So.
Well, we would be more than happy to have you on again at some point in the future to cover other subjects. So.
Sure, I'm happy to do that.
Okay, great. So, all right, listeners, that's going to be it for us. Thank you for joining us. Robin Hanson, thank you very much for your time today. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Take care.
Decentralized is edited and produced by Chaz Ferguson. Music written and performed by Tony Lees. You can download past episodes at decentralized.fm or on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/decentralized-podcast. And follow us on Twitter at decentralizeall.